It's Friday, 19th of April, and this is your Capital Economics Weekly Briefing. I'm David Wilder. Coming up, answers to some of the big current questions in financial markets and the real story behind what's happened to excess savings in advanced economies. But first, Neil Shearing, our Group Chief Economist, joins me to rake over the coals of a busy week in global macro and to read the chicken bones and tell us what to expect in the coming week. Hi there, Neil.
Hi, David.
Now, at this point, we are hardwired to begin this podcast talking inflation and central banks, but we are hours after news started filtering out about Israel's retaliatory attacks on Iran following the drone and missile attacks last weekend. It's a very fluid situation as we head into the weekend. But what can you say at this point in terms of how to gauge macro and market risk around this situation?
So the key channel through which this transmits to the rest of the global economy is oil. As things stand, the increases that we've seen over the past month or so, I don't think pose a substantial risk to inflation in advanced economies. To give you a sense of the order of magnitude, about a $10 increase in the price of oil per barrel adds about 0.1 to 0.2 percentage points to headline inflation in advanced economies. So this doesn't pose, I don't think, a major risk to the outlook for inflation in the US or in Europe. And I think it's worth saying too that both sides, at least at the moment, seem to be trying to keep this conflict contained. So we should expect more volatility in energy markets over the coming weeks and months. Investors are going to have to brace for that. But at this point, I don't think it's a major inflationary concern. And as we've seen actually in markets over the past week or so, the principal concern for investors is still about the general outlook for inflation, the response of central banks, rather than necessarily events in the Middle East.
Let's turn to that inflation question, because the last time we spoke on this podcast, it was pre that March US CPI release. Feels like a very different world now. Doves in retreat, hawks ascendant. But is it really that different? Have things changed that much? It does feel like the pendulum has once again swung too far in the other direction. So tell us, how much has the global inflation picture really changed over the past couple of weeks?
But I think it's changed a bit, but not by as much as the kind of narrative in markets would suggest. It's always unwise to read very much into 1 month's worth of data. Now, I guess a rejoinder to that is that we have had 3 months in the US where inflation has been a bit stronger than expected, January, February and March. But I think the key point there, though, is that a lot of this, or some of this, is definitional. So there's various different measures of inflation in the US and in Europe. There's CPI measure. In the US, we have the PCE measure. And there's what's called the harmonized CPI, HICP, which is another way of calculating inflation. And each of these give you a slightly different read on what's happening to inflation, particularly in the US. So if we take the US CPI number, the core inflation number there is running at a three-month annualized rate of just over 4.5%. But we think the core PCE number, we'll get more data on that in the coming week. But we think at the moment it's probably running at a three-month annualized rate of about 4%, so a bit lower. Yet if you look at the HICP three-month annualized rate, that's running at just over 2%. And that number is broadly similar to the rate of inflation that we have in the Eurozone and in the UK on the same measure. So some of this, the reason I'm laboring this is some of the narrative has been shaped by the fact that in different markets and different economies, we tend to look at different measures of inflation, and it treats housing very differently. It treats medical services very differently, for example, in some of the US measures. So some of this is a definitional point. Well, that being said, I think you can't get away from the fact that inflation has not slowed quite as quickly as we had expected at the start of this year in the US. And you know, for that reason, I think it makes sense that the expectations for rate cuts have been pushed back. Should they be pushed back a long way? So at this stage, there's a 50-50 chance of a September cut priced into the market and then one in November. I suspect markets have probably swung a bit too far in the other direction, as you suggest. And we're still going for a September cut in the US, another one in November. And if you look at our profile across the US and the Eurozone and the UK, over the next 18 months or so, we've got slightly more rate cuts than they're currently priced into markets.
Okay, so Fed rate cut coming in September now. What about this small but growing idea in markets that the Fed will actually wait until next year to cut interest rates? Is that a meaningful risk given what we've seen on the inflation front?
I suppose it's possible given the strength of the US economy, but I don't think it's particularly likely. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that although the US economy has proven to be pretty resilient in the face of higher interest rates, we do expect growth to slow over the course of this year. So we'll have GDP data in the coming week. We've got 2.4% annualized in our forecast. That's down from 3.9% annualized in Q4. So a bit of a slowdown back to something like trend. And I suspect it will slow a bit further over the course of this year. And what's more, I think that some of those forces that have been pushing up inflation in the first few months of this year will start to reverse, in particular the contribution to inflation in the US coming from housing. We know that this is one of the components of the CPI and PCE basket that's a bit more lagging in nature. And some of the forward-looking indicators that we have on rents do suggest the shelter component of both CPI and PCE will start to come down. Of course, it's PCE that really matters for the Fed. So if you look at the latest FOMC projections, they're suggesting that core PCE will be down to about 2.6% in the fourth quarter. A fourth quarter growth will be just over 2%. To me, that still looks pretty achievable, in which case I think a projection of a couple of rate cuts this year still looks reasonable, really.
You spoke about the strength of the US economy there. It seems the economy has taken the monetary tightening so far in its stride, but if the setting is as restrictive as Jerome Powell says, what's the risk that higher for longer takes a greater toll on the economy?
Well, I think one of the reasons why higher interest rates have not had a big impact on the US economy is because households have managed to lock in the low interest rates in the pandemic period by refinancing mortgages. And of course, in the US, mortgages tend to be 30-year fixed rates for the duration of the mortgage. And so that's softened the pass-through, blunted the pass-through of tighter monetary policy to the real economy. Now, the flow of credit has really slowed. So the flow of new credit to the economy is really slow. There's some signs that that's now stabilizing. But the key thing also that's kept the economy going is on the fiscal side. So fiscal policy providing a far greater support to demand in the US than is the case in Europe. And this is the key point too. So for how long will markets allow the US government to continue running these large deficits? The longer that continues without the government taking some kind of remedial action, then I think the greater the risk of some kind of accident in bond markets forcing the government's hand on the fiscal front. There's a genuine sense, I think, in which the longer that rates are kept at these levels, the greater economic damage it will do. It's very difficult to know exactly where neutral interest rates are in the US, but you can think probably the neutral real rate's about 1 to 1.5, so the neutral nominal rate's about 3 to 3.5, something like that. So they're already in restrictive territory. And I think although there are these factors, as I say, that have weakened the pass-through of tighter monetary policies to the real economy, you know, the longer that policy is kept at these restrictive levels, the greater economic damage it will do. But it's not just about monetary policy. It's also about what's happening on the fiscal side. And I think that's a key area to focus on over the next 6-12 months.
Another aspect of these changed US rate expectations is obviously a stronger dollar. The team has done a load of work on this over the past week, and they're going to be briefing about it in 2 drop-ins. Those are our short-form online briefings in the coming week. We've got a Bank of Japan meeting on Friday 26th. The bank raised rates at its last meeting. That hasn't stopped the yen slide. It's at nearly 155 as we're speaking today, Friday morning in London. How problematic is dollar strength for the global economy?
It's back to the old adage, isn't it? That is our dollar and your problem. Actually, I think some of the headlines on this are a little overdone. There are 2 reasons why, if you're a central bank, you worry about having a weak currency, which is the counterpart, obviously, to a strong dollar. One is that it pushes up inflation, so the price of your imports go up. And the second is that it raises the local currency burden of dollar-denominated debt. So this is a problem for central banks and governments. If you get very rapid moves in the exchange rate that would tend to be inflationary or create strains in balance sheets, particularly in economies that have lots of dollar-denominated liabilities and debt. Now, as we look across the globe at this point, the moves in the dollar have not been particularly abrupt or severe. I don't think they pose an inflationary problem. And I also don't think there's much of a balance sheet risk at this point. The moves have been more gradual, and most EMs, this is normally an EM problem, have now tend to borrow in their own currencies rather than in dollars. So yeah, potentially a handful of economies running into problems with a strong dollar in frontier markets. But by and large, I think the major emerging economies will be able to take this in their stride. So a bit of jawboning from central banks, a bit of trying to talk their currencies up and talk the dollar down. But I don't think at this point it's a major cause for concern.
That was Neil Shearing on events in the Middle East and a shift in the inflation and interest rate narrative in markets. I'll link on the podcast page to Neil's note on the Israeli strikes on Iran. That note also has links to the key analysis that we put out on how to think through this conflict in the Middle East. On the inflation and central bank front, we've put out work this past week on the differences between US and European inflation, why we think the ECB is going to wind up cutting rates by more than is indicated by market pricing and consensus forecasts, and our latest views on what all of this means for DM bond yields. Our Europe team is going to be holding a drop-in. That's one of our short-form online briefings to talk about their views on the ECB and the market implications of all of that this coming Thursday. As I mentioned in my chat with Neil, we've also got two sessions on the stronger dollar in the coming week. On Tuesday, looking at how EMs are going to cope, and on Friday, just after that BOJ meeting, looking specifically at what all of this means for the yen and for the renminbi. Details of all of those sessions will be on the podcast page and on our events page, capitaleconomics.com/events. And remember, if you're a client of CE Advanced, that's our premium platform, you get direct access to all our events, all our analysis, all our data, and much more besides. Check it out at capitaleconomics.com/CE-advance. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Simon McAdam about what's really happened with excess savings in advanced economies. But first, to financial markets. Here's a clip from our drop-in all about our new asset allocation outlook held earlier this week. In this extract from the briefing, which I've edited for clarity, you'll hear Chief Markets Economist John Higgins asking the team about three of the key questions around what's been happening in financial markets. Firstly, you'll hear Jonas Gultermann on the Treasury market, what follows that big rise in yields we've seen in recent weeks, and the latest on the inverted yield curve. And then Hubert de Baoucher weighs in on the sustainability of US equities valuations. It starts with Jonas on those moves in Treasury markets.
The momentum certainly seems to be towards higher bond yields for now as the data continues to come in hot. You know, it's starting to feel a bit like a repeat of last autumn, September, October time when we saw a similar move higher in rate expectations and bond yields, which towards the end got a little bit disorderly. And you suddenly see a few signs of a similar nature right now with equity markets selling off a little bit, volatility, implied volatility picking up, and maybe risk premiums following that. But, you know, look, taking a step back, what the Fed has said is essentially that they will be data dependent. We and many others had thought that the data on inflation would improve by now, but it's gone the other way, which is why we've seen this sort of, you know, this big rebound. But we still think later this year that inflation is going to come back towards target. Growth in the US is probably going to soften a bit as you know, the past tightening takes effect and then the overall momentum in the economy slows. And I think at that point, the Fed will be able to shift towards easing and they will eventually deliver rate cuts. I think increasingly their bias does seem to be towards easing now because they're worried about having over tightened. So I think later this year, we are going to see rate expectations come down a bit. You know, we've revised our Fed forecast in the wake of the CPI data, but we still have two cuts this year and quite a few more next year. So more easing that was discounted in the money market. I think we are therefore going to see long-term bond yields also come down later this year. We're sticking to our forecast for 4% on the US Treasury yields by the end of 2024.
Okay, thanks very much. We've had another question come in, bond-related question come in as we've been talking, and that's on the shape of the yield curve and its long-standing inversion and the impact that has on our thinking. You know, is this time different, for example? Can you respond to that?
Yeah, I can give that a go. Fateful word, that this time is different. Four most expensive words in the English language, allegedly. Look, I think the curve eventually is going to disinvert as, you know, policy goes back towards normal. That, I think, is taking, again, it's taking longer than anyone really expected. But I think on our projections, sometime next year, the front end of the curve will be lower than the 10-year yields. I guess the other aspect of this question is around Well, most yield curve inversions are typically followed by recessions in the US and typically also by falls in the stock market. And on that front, we do actually project that something is going to be different in that, you know, there's never, to my mind, been a particularly clear causal link from why does an inverted yield curve cause or lead to a recession and why does it predict it? And there have been instances where the yield curve is inverted and the recession has been avoided. One of those was in the late 90s. And I think our overall assessment is that the situation we have now has got a lot of similarities to the late 90s, where Fed did, you know, tighten very rapidly in the middle of the 90s, managed the soft landing, which is sort of what we're seeing in the US right now, and then liquid markets took off, which again, what we've seen in the US and what we project to continue in the US as we see a sort of dot-com 2.0 forming around AI. So I think, you know, you take those things together, soft landing in an equity market bubble, we probably should be able to dodge a recession this time around. And so what we're looking for is the exception to the rule, but it's not unprecedented.
Okay. Thanks, Jonas. You brought us neatly around to the equity market, which we're going to turn to next, and specifically to you, Hubert, if I may. We had a question come in here about sustainability of valuations in the stock market in the US, given that the 10-year treasury yield has recently risen above the earnings yield of the S&P 500. Jonas touched on the fact that obviously there's been a bubble gradually inflating in the stock market around AI. Is that something that you think will continue to push the stock market higher, or do you see sort of higher treasury yields as really taking some of the wind out of the stock market's sails in a way that they seem to have done perhaps over the last week or two?
Yeah, so it's right that since the start of the month, US equities and actually equities in the rest of the world as well has fallen back. And it seems to have mainly reflected equity investors pricing in interest rates staying higher for longer. But as Jonas mentioned, we do think that the AI narrative will again turn more important in the near term, and in fact that it will remain the case over the next couple of years. So our view that artificial intelligence is a general purpose technology means that we suspect it will have quite big and quite positive impacts for the economy in the next years or even in the next decades. But we also suspect that equity investors will try to crystallize the benefits upfront, as they have done at the start of the year and indeed as they have done in spring last year. And so that is why we think that US equities will continue to, well, will actually rebound and will end next year much higher than they are right now. We forecast that the S&P 500 will end 2025 at 6,500, which is roughly nearly 30% above its level right now. So it's true that valuations are quite elevated. So if you look at either valuations and equity valuations themselves, so price earnings ratio, or if you compare those valuations to the valuations of other assets like US Treasuries, so valuations are quite elevated, but we think that there is scope for them to go even higher. And one example is again the comparison with the dot-com bubble. By the time the gap between the earnings yield of equities and the yield of treasuries was even smaller than it is right now, and even negative on some metrics. And we suspect that this could happen again in the next couple of years.
That was Hubert de Balaché and Jonas Goldman talking to John Higgins about the outlook for financial markets. I'll link to the full recording in the podcast notes, but do visit our events page, which I'll also link to watch recordings of past sessions and to register for upcoming sessions. As I said, we call these online sessions drop-ins. They're short, think 20, 30 minutes tops. They're informal briefings. They're designed to get your questions answered as quickly and clearly as possible so you can get on with your day. Finally this week, excess savings have been thought of as a key prop for advanced economies coming out of the pandemic. The thinking was that households couldn't really spend under lockdown, so they amassed all these savings, and that's cushioned them through monetary tightening. And as central bankers tried to get inflation under control, these savings are now a potential upside inflation risk if households decide to spend them down. But what's the state of these savings and how much of a risk do they really pose? Simon McAdam, our Deputy Chief Global Economist, has just published what we're pitching as the last word on this subject. The report is called Excess Savings RIP. I spoke to Simon earlier in the week about his analysis, and I started by asking what's happened to all of those pandemic era savings.
Well, to some extent, in some economies, it's fair to say that they've been spent on goods and services in the real economy. I mean, this applies mostly to the US. In the US, consumers have been saving a much lower percentage of their income than they did before the pandemic. So that's been propping up spending in the US. So that, in effect, is households running down savings. But we have just got to be clear, it is not necessarily the case that households accumulate excess savings, put those savings in the bank account, and then go out one day and draw down from the bank account, draw down those excess savings, and then spend them in the real economy. That's not necessarily how the concept of running down excess savings actually works in practice. It could be the case that you build up savings, you put them in the bank, and that's contributed to your wealth. And then you keep on receiving an income, and you just decide thereafter to start saving a smaller percentage of that income. That in practice is how many people would have been so-called exhausting their excess savings. They haven't literally gone and got the money and used that to spend in the real economy. They've just saved a smaller percentage of their income. And that's how it shows up in the economic data. We look at the national accounts data in the US. We can see that households have saved a small percentage of their income. And that's unlike in most other advanced economies. So in most other advanced economies, the percentage of income that is saved has fallen from pandemic highs, but it's sort of reverted back to, roughly speaking, around the levels from before the pandemic, or maybe slightly higher, in fact. So households in Europe, for example, have not, generally speaking, saved any less than they did before the pandemic. So there's a big difference there between the US and Europe in particular, and that partly ties into a whole story about why the US economy has been outperforming Europe more generally. So that's one thing that's excess savings have been used for. They've been spent in goods and services, but that's mainly a US story. To a large extent, these excess savings have also been just allocated to other assets. So we take financial assets, for example. An awful lot of this money has been invested in pension funds, and even not pension funds, just in people's, you know, households' holdings of equities and bonds. So if you take the Eurozone as a very stark example of this, there was a pretty steady accumulation of financial assets in the years before the pandemic in the Eurozone. But then the pandemic happened, and then all these excess savings were accumulated. And then Eurozone households went out and accumulated a gigantic excess amount of financial assets, shall we call them. And they amounted to 7% of GDP. So that's to say that the amount of equities, bonds, and pension fund shares that European households own today or are purchased by today are 7% of GDP higher than if pre-pandemic trends had prevailed. So a lot of the money has been invested in the financial markets. And then thirdly, a lot of the money has been tied up with housing. Partly that people have been renovating and extending their homes. Partly some of the money has been spent to buy completely newly built homes. And then an awful big chunk of the money has also been used to buy existing homes. Home sales surged in most advanced economies in 2021 and 2022. If we look at advanced economies on average, home sales of existing homes were about a third higher than we might otherwise have expected them to be in the absence of the pandemic and excess savings. And in many economies, in the Anglosphere in particular, we're talking about excess home sales in the region of 5 to 10% of GDP. You know, so huge amounts of money sloshing around with the households buying homes in far greater volumes and at far greater prices. So yeah, between spending in the real economy, investing in the financial markets, but also buying homes and doing them up as well.
So excess savings are either spent on goods and services, or they've gone into financial assets or into housing markets. But the idea of these excess savings that were built up, does that explain why economies were more resilient than had been expected at the start of all of this monetary tightening?
Yes, I think that's definitely fair to conclude. I mean, it's coming back to the US, it's most obvious in the US because that is where we have seen unusually low saving rates from households. So excess savings meant that households were in a financially strong enough position to be able to save an unusually low amount of their income to boost spending more than we'd otherwise expect. And that has led to a very strong couple of years for the US economy. What's less obvious is the extent to which it has affected other advanced economies, and particularly those in Europe, because that's where saving rates have not been unusually low. In Europe, households have ended up saving roughly the same or slightly higher percentages of their income than they did before the pandemic. And if you look at that, you might think that excess savings have not propped up spending in the European economy. But what's the counterfactual? The counterfactual is that without those excess savings, people probably would have been saving a higher percentage of their income. So compared to a world without excess savings, saving has been lower and spending has been higher, even in the European economy. So even though it's less obvious at first sight, I think it's also propped up spending and activity outside of the US as well. So there's a general advanced economy story here that excess savings accumulated during the pandemic have propped up spending and activity in the face of higher interest rates. And then beyond that, the fact that these financial assets that have been accumulated, both in the form of deposits in terms of unallocated cash, but also the investments, many of the investments that have been allocated to financial assets like bonds and other interest-bearing assets, has meant that households on net have been actually getting a boost to their interest income in the face of higher interest rates, as well as borrowers getting higher interest bills on their existing debt. So it means that for the household sector as a whole, the net interest burden hasn't risen as much as as we've seen in previous tightening cycles. So there's also that indirect way in which excess savings have cushioned households from higher interest rates.
So what does all of this mean from a policy perspective? How should central banks be factoring in this kind of analysis into their thinking about how to best calibrate monetary policy at this stage of the cycle?
Well, I suppose that if you had thought that excess savings not only still existed, but were sort of sitting there primed and ready to be unleashed into the real economy and spent by households in the coming years, you might be concerned about excess demand conditions persisting. And of course, that therefore would present an upside risk to inflation for central banks. But if my analysis is correct, that to the extent that excess savings that exist, they're unlikely to be spent, then in a way that means that you're not going to get that sort of spending impulse and therefore an inflationary impulse. So central banks don't have to worry about this as a potential risk that would throw off plans for them to be cutting interest rates this year. I think that's the bottom line for central banks. But of course, central banks aren't the only ones who'd be interested in this from a policy perspective. Governments, too, have a keen interest in the excess savings debate, because, of course, they need to think about, for future economic downturns, what is the best way of supporting the economy and responding with fiscal policy. You know, we've had big differences in household behavior and saving behavior in recent years between, let's say, the US and Europe. And of course, the US and European governments went about providing support to households in quite different ways during the pandemic. So there may be lessons to be learned from how governments responded during the pandemic for future economic downturns as well.
That was Simon McAdam on excess savings. I'll post his report on the podcast page too, but remember, you can find all of our analysis on our website, capitaleconomics.com, and that CE Advance, our premium platform, gives you all the access, plus data tools and tools to engage directly with our economist team. But that's it for this week. We'll be back next week with the latest on the global macro and market story. Until then, goodbye. Whilst this podcast is provided with all reasonable skill and care, it comprises the subjective views of our economists. Furthermore, these views are not opinions, nor do they constitute investment or financial advice, or are they guarantees or reassurances to the expected results of any investment products or outcome. You should seek your own specific advice in relation to questions you may have. We will have no liability to you in relation to this podcast whatsoever.